preferred to keep his eyes firmly closed, although, when every so often he deigned to open them, I observed their colour, which was blue, ice blue, the blue of recurrence, the fateful blue of Kashmiri sky. But there is no need to elaborate further. We, the children of independence, rushed wildly and too fast into our future. He, emergency born, will be, is already, more cautious, biding his time. But when he acts, he will be impossible to resist. Already he is stronger, harder, more resolute than I. When he sleeps, his eyeballs are immobile beneath their lids. Adam Sinai, child of knees and nose, does not, as far as I can tell, surrender to dreams. How much was heard by those flapping ears which seemed on occasion to be burning with the heat of their knowledge? If he could have talked, would he have cautioned me against treason and bulldozers? In a country dominated by the twin multitudes of noises and smells, we could have been the perfect team. But my baby son rejected speech, and I failed to obey the dictates of my nose.
"Are, Bob," Padma cries, "just tell what happened, mister. What is so surprising if a baby does not make conversations?"
And again, the rifts inside me. "I can't. You must. Yes." April 1976 found me still living in the colony or ghetto of the magicians. My son Adam was still in the grip of a slow tuberculosis that seemed unresponsive to any form of treatment. I was full of forebodings and thoughts of flight, but if any one man was the reason for my remaining in the ghetto, that man was Picture Singh. Padma, Salim threw in his lot with the magicians of Delhi, partly out of a sense of fitness, a self-flagellant belief in the rectitude of his belated descent into poverty. I took with me from my uncle's house no more than 2 shirts, white, 2 pairs trousers, also white, 1 T-shirt, decorated with pink guitars, and shoes, 1 pair, black. Partly, I came out of loyalty, having been bound by knots of gratitude to my rescuer, Parvati the Witch. But I stayed, when, as a literate young man, I might, at the very least, have been a bank clerk or a night school teacher of reading and writing, because all my life, consciously or unconsciously, I have sought out fathers. Amit Sinai, Hanif Aziz, Shopsticker Saab, General Zulfikar have all been pressed into service in the absence of William Methold. Picture Singh was the last of this noble line. And perhaps, in my dual lust for fathers and saving the country, I exaggerated Picture Singh. The horrifying possibility exists that I distorted him, and have distorted him again in these pages, into a dream figment of my own imagination. It is certainly true that whenever I inquired, "When are you going to lead us, Picture G? When will the great day come?" he, shuffling awkwardly, replied,
"Get such things out from your head, Captain. I am a poor man from Rajasthan, and also the most charming man in the world. Don't make me anything else."
But I, urging him on, "There is a precedent. There was Mian Abdullah, the hummingbird," to which Picture,
"Captain, you got some crazy notions."
During the early months of the emergency, Picture Singh remained in the clutches of a gloomy silence, reminiscent, once again, of the great soundlessness of Reverend Mother, which had also leaked into my son, and neglected to lecture his audience in the highways and back streets of the old and new cities, as, in the past, he had insisted on doing. But although he said,
"This is a time for silence, Captain,"
I remained convinced that one day, one millennial dawn at midnight's end, somehow, at the head of a great julus, or procession, of the dispossessed, perhaps playing his flute and wreathed in deadly snakes, it would be Picture Singh who led us towards the light. But maybe he was never more than a snake charmer. I do not deny the possibility. I say only that, to me, my last father, tall, gaunt, bearded, his hair swept back into a knot behind his neck, seemed the very avatar of Mian Abdullah. But perhaps it was all an illusion, born of my attempt to bind him to the threads of my history by an effort of sheer will. There have been illusions in my life. Don't think I'm unaware of the fact. We are coming, however, to a time beyond illusions. Having no option, I must at last set down in black and white the climax I have avoided all evening. Scraps of memory. This is not how a climax should be written. A climax should surge towards its Himalayan peak. But I am left with shreds and must jerk towards my crisis like a puppet with broken strings. This is not what I had planned. But perhaps the story you finish is never the one you begin. Once in a blue room, Amitz and I improvised endings for fairy tales whose original conclusions he had long ago forgotten. The brass monkey and I heard, down the years, all kinds of different versions of the journey of Sinbad and of the adventures of Hatim Tai. If I began again, would I too end in a different place? Well, then, I must content myself with shreds and scraps. As I wrote centuries ago, the trick is to fill in the gaps, guided by the few clues one is given. Most of what matters in our lives takes place in our absence. I must be guided by the memory of a once-glimpsed file with telltale initials, and by the other, remaining shards of the past, lingering in my ransacked memory vaults like broken bottles on a beach. Like scraps of memory, sheets of newsprint used to blow through the magician's colony in the silent midnight wind. Wind-blown newspapers visited my shack to inform me that my uncle Mustafa Aziz had been the victim of unknown assassins. I neglected to shed a tear, but there were other pieces of information, and from these I must build reality. On one sheet of paper, smelling of turnips, I read that the Prime Minister of India went nowhere without a personal astrologer. In this fragment, I discerned more than turnip whiffs. Mysteriously, my nose recognized at once the scent of personal danger. What, I am obliged to deduce from this warning aroma? Soothsayers prophesied me. Might not soothsayers have undone me at the end? Might not a widow obsessed with the stars have learned from astrologers the secret potential of any children born at that long-ago midnight hour? And was that why a civil servant expert in genealogies was asked to trace, and why he looked at me strangely in the morning? Yes, you see, the scraps begin to fit together. Padma, does it not become clear? Indra is India, and India is Indra. But might she not have read her own father's letter to a midnight child, in which her own sloganized centrality was denied, in which the role of mirror of the nation was bestowed upon me? You see? You see? And there is more. There is even clearer proof, because here is another scrap of the Times of India, in which the widow's own news agency, Samacha, quotes her when she speaks of her determination to combat the deep and widespread conspiracy which has been growing. I tell you, she did not mean the Janata Morcha. No. The emergency had a black part as well as a white, and here is the secret which has lain concealed for too long beneath the mask of those stifled days. The truest, deepest motive behind the declaration of a state of emergency was the smashing, the pulverizing, the irreversible discombobulation of the Children of Midnight, whose conference had, of course, been disbanded years before, but the mere possibility of our reunification was enough to trigger off the red alert. Astrologers, I have no doubt, sounded the alarums. In a black folder labelled MCC, names were gathered from extant records. But there was more to it than that. There were also betrayals and confessions. There were knees and a nose and also knees. Scraps, shreds, fragments. It seems to me that immediately before I awoke with the scent of danger in my nostrils, I had dreamed that I was sleeping.
I awoke, in this most unnerving of dreams, to find a stranger in my shack, a poetic-looking fellow with lank hair that wormed over his ears, but who was very thin on top. Yes, during my last sleep, before what has to be described, I was visited by the shade of Nadir Khan, who was staring perplexedly at a silver spittoon inlaid with lapis lazuli, asking absurdly, "Did you steal this? Because otherwise you must be, is it possible, my Mumtaz's little boy?" And when I confirmed, "Yes, none other, I am he," the dream spectre of Nadir Kasim issued a warning, "Hide! There is little time. Hide while you can." Nadir, who had hidden under my grandfather's carpet, came to advise me to do likewise. But too late, because now I came properly awake and smelled the scent of danger blaring like trumpets in my nose. Afraid without knowing why, I got to my feet. And is it my imagination, or did Adam Sinai open blue eyes to stare gravely into mine? Were my son's eyes also filled with alarm? Had flap ears heard what a nose had sniffed out? Did father and son commune wordlessly in that instant before it all began? I must leave the question marks hanging unanswered, but what is certain is that Parvati, my Layla Sinai, awoke also and asked, "What's up, mister? What's got your goat?" And I, without fully knowing the reason, "Hide, stay in here, and don't come out." Then I went outside. It must have been morning, although the gloom of the endless midnight hung over the ghetto like a fog. Through the murky light of the emergency, I saw children playing seven tiles and picture Singh with his umbrella folded under his left armpit, urinating against the walls of the Friday mosque. A tiny bald illusionist was practicing driving knives through the neck of his 10-year-old apprentice. And already a conjurer had found an audience and was persuading large woolen balls to drop from the armpits of strangers, while in another corner of the ghetto, Chand Saab, the musician, was practicing his trumpet playing, placing the ancient mouthpiece of a battered horn against his neck and playing it simply by exercising his throat muscles. There. Over there were the three contortionist triplets, balancing surahis of water on their heads as they returned to their huts from the colony's single standpipe. In short, everything seemed in order. I began to chide myself for my dreams and nasal alarums. But then it started. The vans and bulldozers came first, rumbling along the main road. They stopped opposite the ghetto of the magicians. A loudspeaker began to blare, "Civic Beautification Program. Authorized operation of Sanjay Youth Central Committee. Prepare instantly for evacuation to new site. This slum is public eyesore, can no longer be tolerated. All persons will follow orders without dissent." And while a loudspeaker blared, there were figures descending from vans. A brightly coloured tent was being hastily erected, and there were camp beds and surgical equipment. And now, from the vans, there poured a stream of finely dressed young ladies of high birth and foreign education, and then a second river of equally well-dressed young men, volunteers, Sanjay Youth volunteers, doing their bit for society. But then I realized, no, not volunteers, because all the men had the same curly hair and lips like women's labia, and the elegant ladies were all identical too, their features corresponding precisely to those of Sanjay's Menika, whom new scraps had described as a lanky beauty, and who had once modelled 90s for a mattress company. Standing in the chaos of the slum clearance program, I was shown once again that the ruling dynasty of India had learned how to replicate itself. But then there was no time to think. The numberless labia lips and lanky beauties were seizing magicians and old beggars. People were being dragged towards the vans. And now a rumour spread through the colony of magicians. "They are doing Nasbandi! Sterilization is being performed!" And a second cry, "Save your women and children!" and a riot is beginning. Children who were just now playing seven tiles are hurling stones at the elegant invaders. And here is Picture Singh, rallying the magicians to his side, waving a furious umbrella, which had once been a creator of harmony, but was now transmuted into a weapon, a flapping, quixotic lance. And the magicians have become a defending army. Molotov cocktails are magically produced and hurled. Bricks are drawn out of conjurers' bags. The air is thick with yells and missiles, and the elegant labia lips and the lanky beauties are retreating before the harsh fury of the illusionists. And there goes Picture Singh, leading the assault against the tent of vasectomy. Parvati or Layla, disobeying orders, is at my side now, saying, "My God, what are they?" And at this moment, a new and more formidable assault is unleashed upon the slum. Troops are sent in against magicians, women and children. Once conjurers, card tricksters, puppeteers, and mesmerists marched triumphantly beside a conquering army, but all that is forgotten now, and Russian guns are trained on the inhabitants of the ghetto. What chance do communist wizards have against socialist rifles? We are running now, every which way. Parvati and I are separated as the soldiers charge. I lose sight of Picture Singh. There are rifle butts beating, pounding. I see one of the contortionist triplets fall beneath the fury of the guns. People are being pulled by the hair towards the waiting, yawning vans. And I too am running, too late, looking over my shoulder, stumbling on dalda cans, empty crates, and the abandoned sacks of the terrified illusionists. And over my shoulder, through the murky night of the emergency, I see that all of this has been a smokescreen, a side issue, because hurtling through the confusion of the riot comes a mythical figure, an incarnation of destiny and destruction. Major Shiva has joined the fray, and he is looking only for me. Behind me as I run come the pumping knees of my doom. The picture of a hovel comes into my mind. My son! And not only my son, a silver spittoon inlaid with lapis lazuli. Somewhere in the confusion of the ghetto, a child has been left alone. Somewhere, a talisman guarded for so long has been abandoned. The Friday mosque watches impassively as I swerve, duck, run between the tilting shacks, my feet leading me towards flappy-eared sun and spittoon. But what chance did I have against those knees? The knees of the war hero are coming closer, closer as I flee, the joints of my nemesis thundering towards me, and he leaps. The legs of the war hero fly through the air, closing like jaws around my neck, knees squeezing the breath out of my throat. I am falling, twisting, but knees hold tight, and now a voice, the voice of treachery, betrayal, hate is saying as knees rest on my chest and pin me down in the thick dust of the slum. "So, little rich boy, we meet again. Salaam." I spluttered. Shiva smiled. Oh, shiny buttons on a traitor's uniform, winking, blinking like silver. Why did he do it? Why did he, who had once led anarchistic Apaches through the slums of Bombay, become the warlord of tyranny? Why did Midnight's child betray the children of Midnight and take me to my fate? For love of violence and the legitimizing glitter of buttons on uniforms? For the sake of his ancient antipathy towards me? Or, I find this most plausible, in exchange for the immunity from the penalties imposed on the rest of us? Yes, that must be it. Oh, birthright-denying war hero! Oh, mess of pottage-corrupted rival! But no, I must stop all this and tell the story as simply as possible. While troops chased, arrested, dragged magicians from their ghetto, Major Shiva concentrated on me. I, too, was pulled roughly towards a van. While bulldozers moved forwards into the slum, a door was slammed shut. In the darkness, I screamed, "But my son! And Parvati, where is she, my Layla? Picture Singh, save me, Picture G!"
but there were bulldozers now, and nobody heard me yelling. Parvati the Witch, by marrying me, fell victim to the curse of violent death that hangs over all my people. I do not know whether Shiva, having locked me in a blind, dark van, went in search of her, or whether he left her to the bulldozers, because now the machines of destruction were in their element, and the little hovels of the shantytown were slipping, sliding crazily beneath the force of the irresistible creatures. Huts snapping like twigs, the little paper parcels of the puppeteers and the magic baskets of the illusionists were being crushed into a pulp. The city was being beautified, and if there were a few deaths, if a girl with eyes like saucers and a pout of grief upon her lips fell beneath the advancing juggernauts, well, what of it? An eyesore was being removed from the face of the ancient capital, and rumour has it that during the death throes of the ghetto of the magicians, a bearded giant wreathed in snakes, but this may be an exaggeration, ran full tilt through the wreckage, ran wildly before the advancing bulldozers, clutching in his hand the handle of an irreparably shattered umbrella, searching, searching, as though his life depended on the search. By the end of that day, the slum which clustered in the shadow of the Friday mosque had vanished from the face of the earth. But not all the magicians were captured. Not all of them were carted off to the barbed wire camp called Kichripur, Hotchpotch Town, on the far side of the Jamuna River. They never caught Picture Singh, and it is said that the day after the bulldozing of the magician's ghetto, a new slum was reported in the heart of the city, hard by the New Delhi railway station. Bulldozers were rushed to the scene of the reported hovels. They found nothing. After that, the existence of the moving slum of the escaped illusionists became a fact known to all the inhabitants of the city, but the wreckers never found it. It was reported at Maroli, but when vasectomists and troops went there, they found the Qutb Minar unbesmirched by the hovels of poverty. Informers said it had appeared in the gardens of the Janta Manta Jai Singh's Mughal Observatory. But the machines of destruction, rushing to the scene, found only parrots and sundials. Only after the end of the emergency did the moving slum come to a standstill, but that must wait for later, because it is time to talk, at long last and without losing control, about my captivity in the widow's hostel in Benares. Once Reshim Bibi had wailed, "Ay-oh, ay-oh!" And she was right. I brought destruction down upon the ghetto of my saviours. Major Shiva, acting no doubt upon the explicit instructions of the widow, came to the colony to seize me, while the widow's son arranged for his civic beautification and vasectomy programmes to carry out a diversionary manoeuvre. Yes, of course, it was all planned that way, and, if I may say so, most efficiently. What was achieved during the riot of the magicians? No less a feat than the unnoticed capture of the one person on earth who held the key to the location of every single one of the children of midnight. For had I not, night after night, tuned into each and every one of them? Did I not carry, for all time, their names, addresses, faces in my mind? I will answer that question. I did. And I was captured. Yes, of course, it was all planned that way. Parvati the Witch had told me all about my rival. Is it likely that she would not have mentioned me to him? I will answer that question too. It is not likely at all. So, our war hero knew where in the capital lurked the one person his masters wanted most. Not even my Uncle Mustafa knew where I went after I left him, but Shiva knew. And once he had turned traitor, bribed, I have no doubt, by everything from promises of preferment to guarantees of personal safety, it was easy for him to deliver me into the hands of his mistress, the madam, the widow with the parti-coloured hair. Shiva and Salim, victor and victim, understand our rivalry. You will gain an understanding of the age in which you live. The reverse of this statement is also true. I lost something else that day besides my freedom. Bulldozers swallowed a silver spittoon, deprived of the last object connecting me to my more tangible, historically verifiable past. I was taken to Benares to face the consequences of my inner, midnight-given life. Yes, that was where it happened, in the Palace of the Widows, on the shores of the Ganges, in the oldest living city in the world, the city which was already old when the Buddha was young. Kasi Benares, Varanasi, city of divine light, home of the prophetic book, the horoscope of horoscopes, in which every life, past, present, future, is already recorded. The goddess Ganga streamed down to earth through Shiva's hair. Benares, the shrine to Shiva the god, was where I was brought by Hero Shiva to face my fate. In the home of horoscopes, I reached the moment prophesied in a rooftop room by Ram Ram Seth. "Soldiers will try him, tyrants will fry him," the fortune teller had chanted. Well, there was no formal trial. Shiva knees wrapped around my neck, and that was that. But I did smell, one winter's day, the odours of something frying in an iron skillet. Followed the river past Sindhagat, on which young gymnasts in white loincloths perform one-armed push-ups, past Manikarnikagat, the place of funerals, at which holy fire can be purchased from the keepers of the flame, past floating carcasses of dogs and cows, unfortunates for whom no fire was bought, past Brahmins under straw umbrellas, at the Shashwamedhagat, dressed in saffron, dispensing blessings. And now it becomes audible, a strange sound, like the baying of distant hounds. Follow, follow, follow the sound, and it takes shape. You understand that it is a mighty, ceaseless wailing, emanating from the blinded windows of a riverside palace, the widow's hostel. Once upon a time, it was a Maharaja's residence. But India today is a modern country, and such places have been expropriated by the state. The palace is a home for bereaved women now. They, understanding that their true lives ended with the death of their husbands, but no longer permitted to seek the release of sati, come to the holy city to pass their worthless days in heartfelt ululations. In the Palace of the Widows lives a tribe of women whose chests are irredeemably bruised by the power of their continual pummelings, whose hair is torn beyond repair, and whose voices are shredded by the constant, keening expressions of their grief. It is a vast building, a labyrinth of tiny rooms on the upper stories giving way to the great halls of lamentation below. And yes, that was where it happened. The widow sucked me into the private heart of her terrible empire. I was locked away in a tiny upper room, and the bereaved women brought me prison food. But I also had other visitors. The war hero invited two of his colleagues along, for purposes of conversation. In other words, I was encouraged to talk by an ill-matched duo, one fat, one thin, whom I named Abbott and Costello, because they never succeeded in making me laugh. Here, I record a merciful blank in my memory. Nothing can induce me to remember the conversational techniques of that humourless, uniformed pair. There is no chutney or pickle capable of unlocking the doors behind which I have locked those days. No, I have forgotten. I cannot, will not say how they made me spill the beans. But I cannot escape the shameful heart of the matter, which is that, despite absence of jokes and the generally unsympathetic manner of my two-headed inquisitor, I did, most certainly, talk. And more than talk, under the influence of their unnameable, forgotten pressures, I became loquacious in the extreme. What poured blubbering from my lips, and will not do so now? Names, addresses, physical descriptions. Yes, I told them everything. I named all 578, because poverty, they informed me courteously, was dead, and Shiva gone over to the enemy, and the 581st was doing the talking. Forced into treachery by the treason of another, I betrayed the Children of Midnight. I, the founder of the conference, presided over its end, while Abbott and Costello unsmilingly interjected from time to time, "Aha! Very good! Didn't know about her!" or, "You are being most cooperative. This fellow is a new one on us." Such things happen. Statistics may set my arrest in context. Although there is considerable disagreement about the number of political prisoners taken during the emergency, either 30,000 or 250,000 persons certainly lost their freedom. The widow said, "It is only a small percentage of the population of India." All sorts of things happen during an emergency. Trains run on time. Black money hoarders are frightened into paying taxes. Even the weather is brought to heel. And bumper harvests are reaped. There is, I repeat, a white part as well as a black. But in the black part, I sat bar-fettered in a tiny room on a straw palliasse, which was the only article of furniture I was permitted, sharing my daily bowl of rice with cockroaches and ants. And as for the Children of Midnight, that fearsome conspiracy which had to be broken at all costs, that gang of cutthroat desperados before whom an astrology-ridden Prime Minister trembled in terror, the grotesque, aberrational monsters of independence for whom a modern nation-state could have neither time nor compassion, 29 years old now, give or take a month or two, they were brought to the widow's hostel between April and December. They were rounded up. And their whispers began to fill the walls of my cell, paper-thin, peeling, plastered bare, began to whisper into one bad ear and one good ear, the consequences of my shameful confessions. A cucumber-nosed prisoner, festooned with iron rods and rings, which made various natural functions impossible. Walking using a tin chamber pot, squatting, sleeping, lay huddled against peeling plaster and whispered to a wall. It was the end. Salim gave way to his grief. All my life, and through the greater part of these reminiscences, I have tried to keep my sorrows under lock and key, to prevent them from staining my sentences with their salty maudlin fluidities. But no more. I was given no reason, until the widow's hand, from my incarceration. But who, of all the 30,000 or 250,000, was told why or wherefore? Who needed to be told? In the walls I heard the muted voices of the midnight children. Needing no further footnotes, I blubbered over peeling plaster. What Salim whispered to the wall between April and December 1976. Dear children, how can I say this? What is there to say? My guilt, my shame. Although excuses are possible, I wasn't to blame about Shiva, and all manner of folk are being locked up, so why not us? And guilt is a complex matter, for are we not all, each of us in some sense, responsible for? Do we not get the leaders we deserve? But no excuses are offered. I did it, dear children, and my poverty is dead, and my Jamila vanished, and everyone. Vanishing seems to be yet another of those characteristics which recur throughout my history. Nadir Khan vanished from an underworld, leaving a note behind. Adam Aziz vanished too, before my grandmother got up to feed the geese. And where is Mary Pereira? I, in a basket, disappeared, but Layla or Parvati went fut without the assistance of spells. And now, here we are, disappeared off the face of the earth. The curse of vanishment, dear children, has evidently leaked into you. No, as to the question of guilt, I refuse absolutely to take the larger view. We are too close to what is happening. Perspective is impossible. Later, perhaps, analysts will say why and wherefore. Will adduce underlying economic trends and political developments. But right now we're too close to the cinema screen. The picture is breaking up into dots. Only subjective judgments are possible. Subjectively, then, I hang my head in shame. Dear children, forgive. No, I do not expect you to forgive. Politics, children.
at the best of times. A bad, dirty business. We should have avoided it. I should have never dreamed of purpose. I am coming to the conclusion that privacy, the small individual lives of men, are preferable to all this inflated macrocosmic activity. But too late. Can't be helped. What can't be cured must be endured. Good question, children. What must be endured? Why are we being amassed here like this, one by one? Why are rods and rings hanging from our necks? And stranger confinements, if a whispering wall is to be believed. Who has the gift of levitation has been tied by the ankles to the ring set in the floor, and a werewolf is obliged to wear a muzzle. Who can escape through mirrors must drink water through a hole in a lidded can, so that he cannot vanish through the reflective surface of the drink. And she, whose looks can kill, has her head in a sack, and the bewitching beauties of board are likewise bag-headed. One of us can eat metal. His head is jammed in a brace, unlocked only at mealtimes. What is being prepared for us? Something bad, children. I don't know what as yet, but it's coming. Children, we too must prepare. Pass it on. Some of us have escaped. I sniff absences through the walls. Good news, children. They cannot get us all. Sumitra the time traveller, for instance. Oh, youthful folly. Oh, stupid we, to disbelieve him so. Is not here, wandering perhaps in some happier time of his life. He has eluded search parties forever. No, do not envy him, although I too long on occasion to escape backwards, perhaps to the time when I, the apple of the universal eye, made a triumphant tour as a baby of the palaces of William Methold. Oh, insidious nostalgia for times of greater possibility before history, like a street behind the General Post Office in Delhi, narrowed down to this final full point. But we are here now. Such retrospection saps the spirit. Rejoice, simply, that some of us are free. And some of us are dead. They told me about my Parvati, across whose features to the last there fell the crumbling ghost face of... No, we are no longer 581. Shivering in the December cold, how many of us sit walled in and waiting? I ask my nose... It replies, 420. The number of trickery and fraud. 420 imprisoned by widows, and there is one more who struts booted around the hostel. I smell his stink approaching, receding, the spore of treachery. Major Shiva, war hero, Shiva of the knees, supervises our captivity. Will they be content with 420? Children, I don't know how long they'll wait. No, you're making fun of me. Stop, do not joke. Why? Whence? How on earth this good nature, this bonhomie, in your passed-on whisperings? No, you must condemn me out of hand and without appeal. Do not torture me with your cheery greetings as one by one you are locked in cells. What kind of time or place is this for salams, namaskars, how you beens? Children, don't you understand? They could do anything to us, anything. No, how can you say that? What do you mean with your what could they do? Let me tell you, my friend, steel rods are painful when applied to the ankles, rifle butts leave bruises on foreheads. What could they do? Live electric wires up your anuses, children, and that's not the only possibility. There is also hanging by the feet and a candle. Ah! The sweet romantic glow of candlelight is less than comfortable when applied lit to the skin. Stop it now. Cease all this friendship. Aren't you afraid? Don't you want to kick, stamp, trample me to smithereens? Why these constant whispered reminiscences, this nostalgia for old quarrels, for the war of ideas and things? Why are you taunting me with your calmness, your normality, your powers of rising above the crisis? Frankly, I'm puzzled, children. How can you, age 29, sit whispering flirtatiously to each other in your cells? God damn it, this is not a social reunion! Children. Children, I'm sorry. I admit openly, I have not been myself of late. I have been a Buddha, and a basketed ghost,
and a would-be saviour of the nation. Salim has been rushing down blind alleys, has had considerable problems with reality ever since a spittoon fell like a piece of the... Pity me. I've even lost my spittoon. But I'm going wrong again. I wasn't intending to ask for pity. I was going to say that perhaps I see... It was I, not you, who failed to understand what is happening. Incredible children. We, who could not talk for 5 minutes without disagreeing. We, who as children quarrelled, fought, divided, distrusted, broke apart, are suddenly together, united as one. Oh, wondrous irony. The widow, by bringing us here to break us, has in fact brought us together. Oh, self-fulfilling paranoia of tyrants! Because what can they do to us, now that we're all on the same side? No language rivalries, no religious prejudices. After all, we are 29 now. I should not be calling you children. Yes, here is optimism like a disease. One day she'll have to let us out, and then, wait and see. Maybe we should form, I don't know, a new political party. Yes, the Midnight Party. What chance do politics have against people who can multiply fishes and turn base metals into gold? Children, something is being born here, in this dark time of our captivity. Let widows do their worst. Unity is invincibility. Children, we've won! Too painful. Optimism, growing like a rose in a dung heap. It hurts me to recall it. Enough! I forget the rest. No, very well, I remember. What is worse than rods, bar fetters, candles against the skin? What beats nail-tearing and starvation? I reveal the widow's finest, most delicate joke. Instead of torturing us, she gave us hope, which meant she had something, no, more than something, the finest thing of all, to take away. And now, very soon now, I shall have to describe how she cut it off. Ectomy, from, I suppose, the Greek, a cutting out, to which medical science adds a number of prefixes. Appendectomy, tonsillectomy, mastectomy, tubectomy, vasectomy, testectomy, hysterectomy. Salim would like to donate one further item, free, gratis, and for nothing. To this catalogue of excisions, it is, however, a term which probably belongs to history, although medical science was involved. Sporectomy, the draining out of hope. On New Year's Day, I had a visitor. Creak of door, rustle of expensive chiffon, the pattern green and black, her glasses green, her shoes were black as black. In newspaper articles, this woman has been called a gorgeous girl with big rolling hips. She had run a jewellery boutique before she took up social work. During the emergency, she was semi-officially in charge of sterilization. But I have my own name for her. She was the widow's hand, which one by one, and children, and tearing little balls go greenly, blackly, she sailed into my cell. Children, it begins. Prepare, children. United we stand. Let widow's hand do widow's work, but after. Think of then. Now does not bear thinking about, and she sweetly, reasonably, basically, you see, it is all a question of God. Are you listening, children? Pass it on. The people of India, the widow's hand explained, worship Our Lady like a god. Indians are only capable of worshipping one god. But I was brought up in Bombay, where Shiva, Vishnu, Ganesh, Aurumzada, Allah, and countless others had their flocks. What about the pantheon, I argued, the 330 million gods of Hinduism alone, and Islam, and bodhisattvas? And now the answer. Oh, yes, my God, millions of gods, you are right, but all manifestations of the same Om. You are Muslim.
You know what is Om? Very well. For the masses, Our Lady is a manifestation of the Om. There are 420 of us, a mere 0.00007% of the 600 million strong population of India. Statistically, insignificant, even if we were considered as a percentage of the arrested 30 or 250,000, we formed a mere 1.4 or 0.168%. But what I learned from the widow's hand is that those who would be gods fear no one so much as other potential deities, and that that and that only is why we, the magical children of midnight, were hated, feared, destroyed by the widow, who was not only Prime Minister of India, but also aspired to be Devi, the mother goddess, in her most terrible aspect, possessor of the Shakti of the gods, a multi-limbed divinity with a centre parting and schizophrenic hair. And that was how I learned my meaning in the crumbling palace of the bruised-breasted women. Who am I? Who were we? We were, are, shall be the gods you never had, but also something else. And to explain that, I must tell the difficult part at last. All in a rush, then, because otherwise it will never come out. I tell you that on New Year's Day 1977, I was told by a gorgeous girl with rolling hips that, yes, they would be satisfied with 420. They had verified 139 dead. Only a handful had escaped. So now it would begin. Snip, snip. There would be anaesthetic and count to 10. The numbers marching 1, 2, 3, and I whispering to the wall. Let them, let them. While we live and stay together, who can stand against us? And who led us one by one to the chamber in the cellar where, because we are not savages, sir, air conditioning units had been installed, and a table with a hanging lamp, and doctors, nurses, green and black, their robes were green, their eyes were black. Who, with knobbly, irresistible knees, escorted me to the chamber of my undoing? But you know, you can guess, there is only one war hero in this story, unable to argue with the venom of his knees. I walked wherever he ordered. And then I was there, and a gorgeous girl with big rolling hips saying, "After all, you can't complain. You won't deny that you once made assertions of prophethood. Because they knew everything, Padma. Everything, everything. They put me down on the table and the mask coming down over my face and count to 10 and numbers pounding 7, 8, 9, 10. And good God, he's still conscious. Be a good fellow. Go on to 20. 18, 19, 20. They were good doctors. They left nothing to chance. Not for us the simple vas and tubectomies performed on the teeming masses, because there was a chance, just a chance, that such operations could be reversed. Ectomies were performed, but irreversibly. Testicles were removed from sacs, and wombs vanished forever. Test and hysterectomized, the children of midnight were denied the possibility of reproducing themselves. But that was only a side effect, because they were truly extraordinary doctors, and they drained us of more than that. Hope, too, was excised, and I don't know how it was done, because the numbers had marched over me. I was out for the count, and all I can tell you is that at the end of 18 days on which the stupefying operations were carried out at a mean rate of 23.33 per day, we were not only missing little balls and inner sacs, but other things as well. In this respect, I came off better than most, because drainage above had robbed me of my midnight-given telepathy. I had nothing to lose. The sensitivity of a nose cannot be drained away. But as for the rest of them, for all those who had come to the palace of the Wailing Widows with their magical gifts intact, the awakening from anesthesia was cruel indeed, and whispering through the wall came the tale of their undoing, the tormented cry of children who had lost their magic. She had cut it out of us, gorgeously, with wide rolling hips. She had devised the operation of our annihilation, and now we were nothing. Who were we? A mere 0.00007%. Now fishes could not be multiplied, nor base metals transmuted. Gone forever the possibilities of flight and lycanthropy, and the originally 1001 marvelous promises of a numinous midnight. Drainage below. It was not a reversible operation. Who were we? Broken promises made to be broken. And now I must tell you about the smell. Yes, you must have all of it. However overblown, however Bombay talky melodramatic, you must let it sink in. You must see what Salim smelled in the evening of January 18th, 1977. Something frying in an iron skillet, soft, unspeakable something spiced with turmeric, coriander, cumin, and fenugreek. The pungent, inescapable fumes of what had been excised, cooking over a low, slow fire. When 420 suffered ectomies and an avenging goddess ensured that certain ectomized parts were curried with onions and green chilies and fed to the pie dogs of Benares. There were 421 ectomies performed, because one of us, whom we called Narada or Markandaya, had the ability of changing sex. He or she had to be operated on twice. No, I can't prove it, not any of it. Evidence went up in smoke. Some was fed to pie dogs, and later, on March 20th, files were burned by a mother with party-coloured hair and her beloved son. But Padma knows what I can no longer do. Padma, who once in her anger cried out, "But what use are you, my God, as a lover?" That part at least can be verified. In the hovel of Picture Singh, I cursed myself with the lie of impotence. I cannot say I was not warned, because he told me anything could happen, Captain. It did. Sometimes I feel 1,000 years old, or, because I cannot even now abandon form, to be exact, 1,001. The widow's hand had rolling hips, and once owned a jewellery boutique. I began among jewels in Kashmir in 1915. There were rubies and diamonds. My great-grandparents ran a gemstone store. Form, once again, recurrence and shape. No escape from it. In the walls, the hopeless whispers of the stunned 419, while the 420th gives vent just once. One moment of ranting is permissible to the following petulant question. At the top of my voice, I shriek, "What about him? Major Shiva, the traitor! Don't you care about him?" And the reply from Gorgeous with Big Rolling Hips, "The Major has undergone voluntary vasectomy." And now, in his sightless cell, Salim begins to laugh wholeheartedly, without stinting. No. I was not laughing cruelly at my arch-rival, nor was I cynically translating the word voluntary into another word. No, I was remembering stories told me by Parvati or Layla, the legendary tales of the war heroes philandering, of the legions of bastards swelling in the unectomied bellies of great ladies and whores. I laughed because Shiva, destroyer of the midnight children, had also fulfilled the other role lurking in his name, the function of Shiva Lingam, of Shiva the procreator, so that at this very moment, in the boudoirs and hovels of the nation, a new generation of children, begotten by midnight's darkest child, was being raised towards the future. Every widow manages to forget something important. Late in March 1977, I was unexpectedly released from the palace of the Howling Widows and stood blinking like an owl in the sunlight, not knowing how, what, why. Afterwards, when I had remembered how to ask questions, I discovered that on January 18th, the very day of the end of Snip Snip and of substances fried in an iron skillet, what further proof would you like that we, the 420, were what the widow feared most of all?
the Prime Minister had, to the astonishment of all, called a general election. But now that you know about us, you may find it easier to understand her overconfidence. But on that day, I knew nothing about her crushing defeat, nor about burning files. It was only later that I learned how the tattered hopes of the nation had been placed in the custody of an ancient dotard who ate pistachios and cashews and daily took a glass of his own water. Urine drinkers had come to power. The Janata Party, with one of its leaders trapped in a kidney machine, did not seem to me, when I heard about it, to represent a new dawn. But maybe I'd managed to cure myself of the optimism virus at last. Maybe others with the disease still in their blood felt otherwise. At any rate, I had had, on that March day, enough. More than enough of politics. 420 stood blinking in the sunlight and tumult of the gullies of Benares. 420 looked at one another and saw in each other's eyes the memory of their gelding, and then, unable to bear the sight, mumbled farewells and dispersed for the last time into the healing privacy of the crowds. What of Shiva? Major Shiva was placed under military detention by the new regime. But he did not remain there long, because he was permitted to receive one visit. Roshanara Shetty bribed, coquetted, wormed her way into his cell, the same Roshanara who had poured poison into his ears at Mahalakshmi Racecourse and who had since been driven crazy by a bastard son who refused to speak and did nothing he did not wish to do. The steel magnate's wife drew from her handbag the enormous German pistol owned by her husband and shot the war hero through the heart. Death, as they say, was instantaneous. The major died without knowing that once, in a saffron and green nursing home, amid the mythological chaos of an unforgettable midnight, a tiny, distraught woman had changed baby tags and denied him his birthright, which was that hillock-top world cocooned in money and starched white clothes and things, things, things. Things, a world he would dearly have loved to possess. And Salim? No longer connected to history, drained above and below, I made my way back to the capital, conscious that an age, which had begun on that long-ago midnight, had come to a sort of end. How I travelled! I waited beyond the platform at Benares or Varanasi station, with nothing but a platform ticket in my hand, and leapt onto the step of a first-class compartment as the mail train pulled out, heading west. And now, at last, I knew how it felt to clutch on for dear life, while particles of soot, dust, ash gritted in your eyes, and you were obliged to hang onto the door and yell, "Ohe, Maharaj, open up, let me in, great Sir Maharaj!" While inside, a voice uttered familiar words, "On no account is anyone to open, just fair dodgers, that's all." In Delhi, Salim asks questions. "Have you seen where? Do you know if the magicians... Are you acquainted with Picture Singh?" A postman with the memory of snake charmers fading in his eyes points north. And later, a black-tongued panwala sends me back the way I came. Then, at last, the trail ceases meandering. Street entertainers put me on the scent. A dilly deco man with a peep show machine, a mongoose and cobra trainer wearing a paper hat like a child's sailboat, a girl in a cinema box office who retains her nostalgia for her childhood as a sorcerer's apprentice. Like fishermen, they point with fingers. West, 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 until at last Salim arrives at the Shadipur bus depot on the western outskirts of the city. Hungry, thirsty, enfeebled, sick, skipping weakly out of the paths of buses roaring in and out of the depot, gaily painted buses, bearing inscriptions on their bonnets such as "God willing" and other mottos, for instance, "Thank God" on their backsides, he comes to a huddle of ragged tents, clustered under a concrete railway bridge, and sees, in the shadow of concrete, a snake-charming giant breaking into an enormous rotten-tooth smile, and in his arms, wearing a t-shirt decorated with pink guitars, a small boy of some 21 months, whose ears are the ears of elephants, whose eyes are as wide as saucers, and whose face is as serious as the grave. Abracadabra. To tell the truth, I lied about Shiva's death. My first out-and-out lie. Although my presentation of the emergency in the guise of a 635-day-long midnight was perhaps excessively romantic and certainly contradicted by the available meteorological data. Still and all, whatever anyone may think, lying doesn't come easily to Salim. And I'm hanging my head in shame as I confess. Why, then, this single barefaced lie? Because, in actuality, I've no idea where my changeling rival went after the widow's hostel. He could be in hell or the brothel down the road, and I wouldn't know the difference. Padma, try and understand. I'm still terrified of him. There is unfinished business between us, and I spend my days quivering at the thought that the war hero might somehow have discovered the secret of his birth. Was he ever shown a file bearing 3 telltale initials, and that roused to wrath by the irrecoverable loss of his past, he might come looking for me to exact a stifling revenge? Is that how it will end, with the life being crushed out of me by a pair of superhuman merciless knees? That's why I fibbed anyway. For the first time, I fell victim to the temptation of every autobiographer, to the illusion that since the past exists only in one's memories and the words which strive vainly to encapsulate them, it is possible to create past events simply by saying they occurred. My present fear put a gun into Roshanara Shetty's hand. With the ghost of Commander Sabarmati looking over my shoulder, I enabled her to bribe, coquette, worm her way into his cell. In short, the memory of one of my earliest crimes created the fictitious circumstances of my last. End of confession. And now I'm getting perilously close to the end of my reminiscences. It's night. Padma is in position. On the wall above my head, a lizard has just gobbled up a fly. The festering heat of August, which is enough to pickle one's brains, bubbles merrily between my ears, and 5 minutes ago, the last local train yellow and browned its way south to Churchgate Station, so that I did not hear what Padma said with a shyness cloaking a determination as powerful as oil. I had to ask her to repeat herself, and the muscles of disbelief began to nictate in her calves. I must at once record that our dung lotus has proposed marriage. So that I can look after you without going to shame in the eyes of the world. Just as I feared. But it's out in the open now, and Padma, I can tell, will not take no for an answer. I have been protesting like a blushing virgin, so unexpected. And what about the ectomy? And what was fed to pie dogs, don't you mind? And Padma, Padma, there is still what chews on bones. It will turn you into a widow. And just think one moment, there is the curse of violent death. Think of poverty. Are you sure? Are you sure you're sure? But Padma, her jaw set in the concrete of a majestically unshakable resolve, replied, "You listen to me, mister. But me no buts. Never mind all that fancy talk anymore. There is the future to think of. The honeymoon is to be in Kashmir. In the burning heat of Padma's determination, I am assailed by the demented notion that it might be possible, after all, that she may be capable of altering the ending of my story by the phenomenal force of her will, that cracks and death itself might yield to the power of her unquenchable solicitude. There is the future to think of, she warned me, and maybe, I permit myself to think for the first time since I began this narrative, maybe there is an infinity of new